Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with New York City trombonist David Gibson. He has spent many years planting seeds that have come into good fruition these days. He is in demand in a very thriving New York City jazz scene and just released a new album called Boom. He's a cat that has a very curious and intense drive along with the sound to match it. Over our interview, he spoke about late nights at Smalls in New York, the intrigue of the trombone, and much, much more. Dig it, my friends.
Hey, first of all, before we begin, thank you for taking a little time to talk with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, I appreciate that you're interested in talking to me, so we're in the same boat.
Right on. Sounds good. Well, let's go ahead and start things off, and I want to ask you, first of all, what has been going on with you lately?
That sounds like a loaded question. Well, what's been going on with me lately? I don't know. There seems to be kind of a convergence going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there have been a lot of seeds planted over the last maybe 5 or 6 years. And those seeds are kind of starting to sprout. And during those 5 or 6 years, I was really working hard to till the soil, so to speak, to continue the metaphor, I guess. But
sure.
You know, I was putting myself in positions to play with people that I wanted to play with, and sometimes that meant sacrificing money and time to do it. But it's what I wanted to do, and when I came to New York, 16 years ago or whatever, I kind of made a little silent pact with myself that I was going to be discriminating because I was older than a lot of the people I was working with when I got to town, because I came to town after I had already graduated with my master's degree, and then, you know, had started a family. And so I came here and I was in my late 20s, and most of the people that I was around at that point were all, you know, 18, that were all 10 years younger than me. And so I felt this kind of, that I had a perspective that, you know, I don't have time to waste here. I need to, like, get right to it. And anything that I'm doing that's making me feel unfulfilled, or it's not moving me in the direction, it's not challenging me, I don't want to be in that situation. I don't want to be in that same situation 20 years from now, you know?
Yeah.
So it took me a while to be actually brave enough to implement that fully. And once I started doing that, I started enjoying myself a lot more on the gig. And opportunities started appearing, one of which was with George G's Swing Orchestra, and I was, I was working with George's band a little bit as a sub, and George has a singer named John Dokes in the band who's, he's a great guy, and he's quite an entertainer, and he wanted to have some music done for the group, so I wrote or transcribed a few things that he had requested from the Joe Williams Count Basie collaborations. And we got to one of them, and I just said, "Hey man, you know, wouldn't you rather have your own arrangement of this?" And he said, "Well, I don't know, would I?" And I said, "Yes." So I wrote an arrangement for him of that tune. The tune was Thou Swell. And I said, I'll write it where you can do what you want to do. I'll put it in your key. Everything will be cool. Just trust me. So I wrote an arrangement, and that led to another and another. And eventually I started writing a lot for George G's band. And that was a great laboratory within which to learn. And then around the same time, I was talking with Roy Hargrove one night. We were both hanging out late night at Smalls, and I knew a lot of the people that were in his big band. And I said, "Hey man, you know, I know you guys just got back in town. I heard you guys had a great time." And he goes, I said, everybody said it was a great tour. And he goes, really? And I said, yeah, everybody had a great time. He goes, man, thanks for telling me that. And I just said, hey, man, if you ever were looking for an arrangement for that band, I'd love to write for you. And he says, well, since you mentioned it, yeah, I like this John Hicks tune, After the Morning. Do you know it? I said, no. So the next day, I went on a search and found several recordings of After the Morning. One was in my my own collection that I had forgotten about. And so I transcribed it and wrote a big band arrangement. And I called him on the phone like the next week or something. I said, yeah, I have it. It's done. So we met down at one of the clubs in the West Village, and I gave him the score and the parts. And then like a week later, I heard them debut it on BGO, a live radio broadcast. And I guess he passed it out that morning and told everybody, we're going to play this today. So, and then I started writing more things for him. And then I told Oren, Oren Evans, I said, I want to write for you. And so it was really just about asking and realizing, you know, these are situations that excite me, that inspire me, and I want to be a part of them. So I just kind of asked. And then that's now, at this point, I'm getting calls with, you know, people asking me. And sometimes it's a little stressful because everybody's in a hurry.
Yeah.
So if you get three calls in a week, that means you have three big band arrangements you have to write that week because everybody needs it in a hurry.
Yeah.
But I love it. And the thing that I really love about George's situation in particular is that we work together all the time. And so I know the personalities of that band, and I write specifically for them because, you know, I love all the guys. And so what I did when I came in and started getting my feet under me in George's situation, I just started writing features for everybody in the band. And there's really not a whole lot that's more gratifying for me as a writer than to be on the bandstand, and it's palpable. You can feel everybody getting excited by the music, and to realize that, wow, I had some part in this,
yeah,
you know, in an architectural way, and that I'm looking out at an audience that's having a great time. I'm looking at the musicians on the bandstand having a great time. I'm hearing what they're bringing to whatever I put down on paper and personalizing it. And that's really exhilarating. That's when you pop out of bed the next morning excited about what happened the night before.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the beauty of all of this is that it's so simple to ask somebody for something, because the worst thing you're going to get is no, but the best thing you're going to have is what you have right now, which is in demand and having someone like Roy Hargrove pick it up. So a lot to be said for that, for sure.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, part of asking is there's two things. It's a risky proposition because you're basically telling somebody, I can do this job.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you don't know if you can do the job.
Sure.
So you create the problem so that you have to solve it. And it's scary, but every single time I go through this process, somebody calls and they say, I need this arrangement. And then I have this moment of anxiety where I take the gig and then I'm like, oh geez, can I do this? Am I going to be able to do this? And in some cases it involves, you know, getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning, the day of the sound check, and finishing the shout chorus and printing parts and running out the door to rehearsal. It always gets done.
yeah, right on. And that's the key. So speaking about all the seeds that you've planted over the years, another seed is called the album Boom.
Yes.
How has that been going for you? It's a great listen. I've been listening to it. Talk to me a little bit about how this evolved from seed to fruition, and just a little bit about this album.
Well, I had done a couple of previous records for Positone with organist Jared Gold. And Jared and I have a steady gig together. We play the first Friday of every month down in the village at a place called Fat Cat. And so the way we approach the gig is we were both writing music. So one month we would play all Jared's music and he would call the other musicians that he wanted to play his music. Of course, one of them had to be me. And then I would do the same. The next month I would call the band to compliment Jared and I, and I would program my own music. And so we kind of we did that for a while, and then whenever Jared would have to miss, I would call an organ player, and then it just got to the point where I thought, well, why don't I just call a piano, bass, and drums and try something new? And the guys that I'm playing with now evolved over the course of a few years of kind of doing that and booking gigs at other clubs like Smalls and, well, other clubs, Smoke. But so when I would do those gigs, I started approaching it the same way, where I was starting to write music for the guys in the band and to be thinking about them when I was composing. And just to be very aware of the way the group interacted, much in the same way that a basketball coach would be aware of how his players were interacting and what roles everyone's serving. And so, after about 2 years, the group kind of edited itself into this band that I have now. I'm like the luckiest guy in the world. Like, I go to work and I go to work with people that I enjoy all the time. You know, and
absolutely.
And the music is, to me, is hand in hand with that. These guys challenge me, push my perspective in different directions, and it's just always it's a team effort, so the band on Boom is comprised of Josh Evans on trumpet, Theo Hill on piano, Alex Claffey on bass, and Kush Abday on drums. And most of those guys I kind of met by hanging out on the Smalls scene. Basically, Smalls is like the go-to joint when you get out of work, because they're right. Open till 4. And so everybody goes and hangs out there, and there's a session. So, you know, maybe Roy is hanging out and everybody's kind of, you know, like listening to Roy, and then Josh gets up there and plays with Roy. And then it's a big party. It's a big, huge party.
Yeah.
And, it's a party. It's funny because there's still so much pride in performance. So in a sense, it's like you're in this social environment and everyone's playing. Everyone's doing their absolute best, you know, as if they were being paid to play.
Sure.
And so, yeah, that band kind of, I got to hear all of those guys play in that environment. And so I started realizing who I really enjoyed.
Absolutely. So let's go back into your lineage down to the beginning and the roots of you in Oklahoma. What was it about growing up in Oklahoma, about your life at that point, that really kind of got you into enjoying and loving jazz?
Well, my family, they weren't musicians, but we had music in the house, and I guess perhaps my mom had a membership to the Columbia House Record Club, and
yeah.
So. And I'm guessing she selected jazz as her genre that she enjoyed, or one of them, because I remember getting Nancy Wilson records and Miles Davis records and Buddy Rich records and Count Basie records. And so, you know, we had all these recordings, and to me, they weren't things that I necessarily listened to when I was young, but I do remember seeing all of those, the LP jackets.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whether I knew it or not, it was just like, oh yeah, Count Basie. I mean, that's something I, you know, I just accept that as part of our musical world. And when I was in eighth grade, I was going to school in Yukon, Oklahoma. And when I was in eighth grade, I, at the end of that year, decided that I didn't really want to continue with the trombone anymore. And I was kind of done with it. You know, I was just dealing with normal eighth grade garbage. And the jazz ensemble director at the high school called my mom and said, look, you know, we heard about your kid. We'd like to have him come and be a part of the jazz ensemble program that we have here at the high school. And every summer we do like a, you know, we meet 2 days a week for a month. And just, it's almost like, you know, spring training in baseball. It's just, it's training camp.
Yeah.
And would you like to have your son participate? So she asked me, I was like, no. They said, well, look, have him come to one rehearsal. Just have him come to one rehearsal. So I go to the rehearsal. And so here I am, eighth grader going into ninth grade. And I sit down in the middle of a trombone section in a big band full of players who, what I didn't realize is this band was recognized as one of the top high school programs in the state for jazz ensembles. So I sit down in this unit of people who are playing head and shoulders above me at that point. And, you know, I got my behind kicked.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the first time that I'd ever felt that. And it was so exciting that I had to be involved. It was like, wow, I just got my butt kicked. I got to do this again. So, that freshman year in high school, I got really motivated. And one of the things that our director did is he had a deep collection of LPs that he kept in his office, and he would just let us take them home. And I would make cassette tapes of all of these recordings. And so I just started listening to jazz all the time, and also started taking some improvisation lessons. And I don't think I really understood much about the improvisation part of it, but the thing that really struck me was the feel of the music and the feel of what it was to swing and what that felt like. And I think that's still the thing that gets me, is the feel.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this. What was there a person that pitched New York City to you that said, you have to go there? Or was that always kind of a dream that you had? How did that happen?
Well, when I was in college in Oklahoma, I was really excited about the music, and I was reading Downbeat, and I was, you know, buying lots of records, and old records and new records. And of course, you know, you're in college and you got a whole group of people who are cross-pollinating each other's ears because, well, he's got these records and I have these records. And there were a few albums that I remember hearing that really turned me on. One was this Slide Hampton and Dexter Gordon record called A Day in Copenhagen. That record really blew my mind because I'd never heard the trombone played like that. And just in terms of the linear and harmonic approach that Slide was using on that record, I was like, whoa, I've never heard this. There was another record of Slide's that he didn't really even play on, but it was a Slide like little big band thing recorded at the Vanguard called Dedicated to Diz. And it's really kind of seems like the first iteration of what became like the Dizzy Gillespie alumni band. And man, that record, the way it was recorded, I could hear the club, I could hear, you know, everything. And that was when I was in Oklahoma, and I was like, man, I want to go to New York. And then I left Oklahoma and I went to Rochester to go to graduate school. And when I was in Rochester at graduate school, there was another record that I heard. It was the same way. It was a Gary Bartz recording called There Goes the Neighborhood. And it was the same thing. I just felt like, this is what New York sounds like. I want to experience this. And so it was his own little beacon, New York was. Nobody told me to. In fact, I think more people told me not to. You know, a lot of people did tell me not to. I remember telling someone when I was in Rochester, telling them that I was going to move to New York, and they told me some story about, you know, seeing Kenny Dorham working at Macy's. And I'm like, dude, why are you telling me this? You know, let me do what I'm going to do. Why are you trying to crush my groove, you know?
Yeah.
I'm glad you didn't go, because you didn't want to have to work at Macy's. But to me, working at Macy's and playing with the baddest cast in the world, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and what an uninteresting world it would be if everybody that listened to their people around them didn't go to New York. What the world would be like.
Well, you know? Listen, I think it's, there's, you know, this Napoleon Hill book called Think and Grow Rich?
Yeah.
Yeah, the one thing that I got out of that book, it was recommended to me by a mentor, and I read it, and I checked it out. And the one thing that I got was about persistence. And, you know, what is the successful person, what do the successful person and the failure have in common? What they have in common is that they both fail. But what they don't have in common is the successful person tries again and tries again. And so my philosophy is it's not, I'm not on a timeline. I just want to improve, and I want to just be better at everything. So, you know, I told someone one time, they were beating themselves up about not having known something sooner. And I said, listen, do you think the archaeologist that brushed the last dust off of the last stone that opened up King Tut's tomb looked inside and said, we're so stupid. This has been here for thousands of years. We should have found it sooner. No, they didn't. You know, they were excited for the discovery. And that's what I never want to lose. I just want to be excited for the discovery.
Right on. Speaking of that excitement, how many doors were open for you in 2003 when you were part of the Thelonious Monk International Trombone Competition? What was that like after that?
I would say that I don't think any doors were open. I think what happened for me perhaps was because my name was out there, I would meet somebody and I would say my name and they'd go, oh, yeah. And that lasted for, you know, a few months, maybe. And
yeah.
I mean, I guess I think I can only think of two people really that said something, maybe three, that said something and acknowledged me in a way that I hadn't been acknowledged before. But there were no gigs or, you know, nothing really came of that. It was the same thing that I was just talking about in the last few years. It was anything that was happening then was just because I was asking.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, can I be involved in this? Can I have a gig? Can I write for you? Can I, you know, it's like, I just want to be involved. And so the monk competition was difficult for me. I'm not really made up like that. My mind is not really equipped for that type of a competitive environment. I take pride in what I do, and I always want to do my best, but it was a distraction for me to think that I was working against someone else. You know, I had to keep telling myself, don't think that way. Don't think that way.
Yeah.
It's okay if somebody is great. You know, everybody here is great. So you just have to be yourself. And, you know, I was too young then to really know how to do that effectively.
Absolutely. So, you know, speaking of your contemporaries, I read a quote in your bio that's pretty impressive. Curtis Fuller said, of all the young players are here in music today, David is one of the very few who speaks the language of jazz. That's pretty impressive. How do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, I love Curtis. Curtis, I know what he means when he says that. I do know what he means. And I remember sitting with Curtis and playing my first record for him. And we were sitting in a hotel in Graz, Austria, and I gave it to him, and he goes, no, 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 come and sit down in my room. We're going to listen to it together. I was like, oh okay. And then every once in a while, he'd kind of smile. He'd look at me, and he'd say, that's some of my stuff. And I was like, yeah, there's a lot of your stuff in there. You're all in there. And so I knew what he was talking about when he said that. And I really appreciated that, because I do think of everything as language. And I think that when, no matter if I'm programming an album for, you know, a recording session, or I'm programming a set, or I'm writing one tune, or I'm playing a solo, I'm thinking about what's the story, what's the message, what do I want to convey, what vernacular, what vocabulary do I have that will effectively convey what I'm thinking right now, and oh, by the way, I'm working with these other people here, and we're all talking at the same time, so I need to give them room to interject and to support me and offer their own musical commentary to kind of further the narrative. And so, you know, it is language. And so when Curtis says that, it just means it helps me put my foot on the gas a little bit more and take it off the brake, because what he says is you're going in the right direction.
Right.
You don't have to slow down.
Speaking of other people, luminaries, you play with Sly Hampton, Roy Hargrove, Jimmy Heath, James Moody. What is it like to be around cats like that, that are such legendary luminaries in the jazz universe, so to speak?
Well, when I was doing it, it was really intimidating. And once again, that's my mind. That's how my mind works. I think there was such a sense of reverence that I had for those people. But, you know, there were some of those folks who made it really easy for me to find my way and get a sense of balance in those situations. Benny Powell was one of those. James Moody was one of those. Those two guys were very kind and very encouraging, and they offered a lot of clarity for me. Especially Benny, he was a student of the world, and you know, he was often very good counsel about any number of things. And Moody really exemplified what I was referring to earlier in terms of maintaining a sense of curiosity and discovery, and having that be what guides you, is just that appetite for the next discovery. And so Moody would, you'd be in the break room, and Moody would walk up to you and he'd say, play this. And he'd play three notes. And then, okay. And then he would say, all right, now play this. And he'd play three more notes. And what he's doing is he's teaching you this exercise. And he just would teach it to you by rote. And so, you know, I would get it and I'd start to understand what he was talking about. And he would do that every day. You know, he would just give you something else. And then he would look at you and he'd go, now show me what you're working on. And then, okay. And you'd show him what you're working on. And then you'd be on the bandstand and he'd stand up and take a solo. And then he'd turn around and look at you because he just played what you showed him. And then you'd play what he showed you. And then he'd turn around and look at you like, ah. So, you know, those experiences, my mind was a cluttered mess full of, you know, taking it all in. I never quite felt like I was in tune. And I look back and I know I wasn't. But those experiences definitely brought me to where I am at right now. You know, a lot, like at least I could recognize that my mind was a jumbled mess, I guess.
Well, you kick everything off this interview perfectly by talking about the seeds. That metaphor is kind of rang through. And I would think to be around cats like that would really plant seeds for, you know, pearls of wisdom and ways that you would approach the jazz business in the years to come.
Sure. Speaking of Curtis Fuller, I asked him one time, I said, what was it like, you know, being around Wayne all the time? And he said, in his little Curtis poetic way, he said, Wayne Shorter is like a bag of dots. And I said, please explain. He said, well, when you're dealing with him, like when you're with him, he's just a bag of dots. But as you move away, you start to see the picture. So, I, you know, I get that, and I think that's when you ask about those experiences. I mean, they're even more instructive now than they were then, because now I have more experiences with which to compare them.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we're all like bags of wine. We maturate over time and things start making a little bit more sense as the rearview mirror separates us, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But one thing, too, I'm curious about, the other side of you is that you're an educator. I'm curious is that, speaking of all these people that have kind of taught you over the years, what do you try to teach your students about music and jazz?
Well, I mean, there's some foundational things. I mean, what we discussed earlier about language. Language is really important. I think that what I want my students to realize is that we're performing a service for an audience, and I never want it to feel narcissistic or self-absorbed. I always want to acknowledge the fact that someone's listening. And so I want them to get that, to realize that when you play, you have to play with the kind of enthusiasm that you would deliver an oral exam in your classroom. You want to share your thoughts, and you want to be believed. So you have to present your thoughts in a way that they can be understood, and you have to present them with the kind of confidence that they can be believed. And most of these students that I teach are not going to be professional musicians. And so I think that the lessons that music can teach them in that regard are vital to their success in other areas of their life. And it also gives them kind of an understanding of the details in order to enrich their own enjoyment of music when they're listening or playing. So, life is to be enjoyed, as my mentor Eddie Pizant says all the time. Life is meant to be enjoyed. And so what I want to do is help these kids take music into their adult lives and be able to enjoy their lives more, and also have an outlet beyond whatever their vocation is, to be able to go to this other place and find that enjoyment, and then take that back into their vocation again, or cross-reference it, or see how they can be better, doctors because they're better musicians.
Absolutely. Speaking of enjoyment, what's the greatest thing about New York City?
The people.
Yeah.
Just all different kinds of people. The beautiful dissonance of everybody trying to do what they need to do, but you have to cooperate. The idea that, you know, you can look at one of those videos of Grand Central at rush hour, and somehow everybody gets to where they're going, and people aren't running into each other. it's like there's an inherent cooperation that has to happen, and it does. But it's almost like a game of chicken. Nobody surrenders until the last second. And so there's that kind of energy. It's almost like, it's almost like popcorn. Hearing those first two kernels of popcorn popping, and you know it's coming. And I like that. I like that energy in the city. And I like that the city has a nightlife. I like, because a lot of places everybody goes to bed at 10 p.m. And, I didn't go to bed last night until almost 5 a.m. because I had a gig. And then after the gig, several of the musicians and I went to another venue and listened to some music, and then went to another venue and listened to some music. And eventually I got home and was still exhilarated and couldn't sleep. So, New York is like the only place that I can do that. And it's a real, there's a community in the musical world as well. And I don't know, I love people. I really enjoy people. And to me, music, people, it's all the same thing. So New York provides a lot of inspiration daily.
Absolutely. How about the trombone? What do you like best about that instrument?
What do I like best? Boy, you really asked that question in the most difficult way for me to compose an answer, because if you'd asked me what I liked worst, I would have a lot of answers for you.
As is life. It's like making a list of the 10 good and the 10 bad.
Well, let's put it like this. I think that trombone is a very revealing instrument, because it is, as J.J. Johnson said one time, I think, I heard him say it was this gangly, awkward, tubular instrument. And it is, and it's clumsy, and it requires a lot of effort to sound graceful. So because of the obstacles that the instrument presents, one has some decisions to make, and the decisions that you make reveal how your mind works, because the trombone doesn't play around.
Yeah.
So, in my case, you know, I don't necessarily have the technical fluency that other instruments have, the ease to play. So I have to make decisions constantly based on what I'm capable of on the instrument. And so, you know, I'm not the guy who can dunk from the foul line, but, you know, I can set a pick, or I can get under the basket and catch a pass for a layup, you know, and the layup's worth 2 points. So I just want to be able to make a strong presentation on the bandstand and the trombone. I guess as I'm delivering this very ambiguous answer, I will say my favorite thing about the trombone is the sound.
Yeah.
I love the sound of the instrument. And so that ends up being something that I think about a lot. And when I'm trying to make my musical statements, I want my voice to be up to the task. I want my voice to be strong enough and compelling enough that somebody wants to listen, and that it makes them feel something. And I think the trombone is an instrument that can do that.
Yeah, without a doubt. So you've dedicated your life to jazz, so it would be safe to say that you have a love affair with jazz. What do you love the most about jazz?
The people. I love the people. I love the conversation. I mean, that's why I got home so late last night, because I was sitting with Kush Abadeh and his lady at the bar at Smalls until they told us to get out. And we weren't talking about music. We were talking about life.
Yeah.
And those are the types of conversations that when you get on the bandstand and you have an understanding with somebody like that, it changes the way you play together.
Yeah.
And so, man, that's what I absolutely love about the music. I mean, and it's built into jazz. The whole situation is about a conversation. And I think that, you know, what I've noticed is my favorite jazz musicians are the ones who include the audience in the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's say here in the next week or so, you walk out of Smalls, you get kicked out again, and there's a DeLorean. There's a DeLorean sitting out front, and you have the opportunity to climb into that thing and punch in a date and go back in time and meet any jazz musician and talk to them. Who would it be?
Wow. That's a really good question. Man, I guess I would probably say Miles Davis. And the reason that I would say Miles is because there's such an image that we just accept about him. And I know there's more to him. He was a human being. And I would love to have a conversation with him as a human being. I think the same would be true of Train. I would be interested in talking to John Coltrane in the same way. And those kind of seem like obvious choices. They almost seem like cliche choices, but the reason for those choices is because they are so cliche or seemingly cliche that these are the two iconic images of jazz, or two of them, that the general public knows and that all jazz musicians know, and there's a mythology associated with them that I think is probably not completely accurate, and I would love just to know what they think.
Absolutely. You know, I've always had kind of a personal fascination with Miles Davis myself, and I've watched him in a lot of interviews, and when he really starts kind of getting out of the icon role and he starts getting real, I always kind of notice the interviewers don't quite know what to do, because he'll bust into these lines of just real deep thought, like things that are not 2D, that have four dimensions, and that really cut to the matter of him being a human. And that was the thing, I think, that I've learned of kind of watching interviews with him. I mean, there was the sunglasses, and he was like, I love the limo ride over, and kind of being cheeky, but I think that was his act. But when he started getting real, Miles Davis, I think, just like what you're saying, was a vastly different human being than what this world is ever going to get out of his art and what he gave to us as a jazz force.
Well, I'll say this. I agree with you, but I would say his art actually does give us everything.
Yeah.
And it's all in there. The decisions that he made, whether those, if you just look at him as a band leader, not even as a player, but just as a band leader, and you see what he did and the deliberate decisions that he made, that tells you a lot about him as a person.
Absolutely. What do you like? What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
The potential to learn and get a little bit better, and to employ the knowledge that I've gathered and to try and capture some more, to ask the right questions of myself so that I come to conclusions that are helpful to everyone around me. I love my family life. And it presents its own challenges, and everything is related. There's a book by Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot called The Third Chapter, and in the premise of the book is based on the fact that everybody gets to their third chapter in life. We think of this being about 50 years old, and she says about writing the book that she was having all of these conversations with people who were her age, about 50 at the time. And everyone started saying, hey, listen, don't tell anybody, but I just started taking opera lessons, and, you know, or hey, don't tell anybody this. It's silly, but I'm going skydiving. And so what she saw, and I'm just paraphrasing here, is that you get to a point in your life at that stage where your sense of your own mortality begins to outweigh your fear of being silly.
Right.
And so these things that you've had the pause button on for years, or that you said, oh, one day I want to do this, one day I want to do this. Well, you realize that day should be today, because I don't know what's coming down the road. And so what she saw in these people was that all of them, as they shed their fear and then they explored this new venue for their creativity, it taught them about the other thing that they had been doing all their life, whether they were a doctor or whatever their vocation was. They learned about that through this other pursuit. And so what I'm getting at is that I have a real global sense that everything is music. My relationship with my wife is music. My relationship with my children is music. And sometimes there's dissonance, and sometimes there's resolution, and it's going on in a constant cycle, and I just want to just keep improving and making better decisions.
Right on. Let's say we hook up in 10 years and talk about what's been going on in your life. What are you going to be excited to tell me about?
I'll probably sound a lot like what I do right now, I hope.
Yeah.
I hope. I can't imagine that I won't. You know, I had a conversation with someone at a cocktail party recently, and he was asking me about the record. And this was a non-musician, but another artist, but not a musician. And he was congratulating me on some things and saying, you know, I'm really, you know, that's impressive. And I said, you know, it's funny that you say that, because if I was on your end of this conversation and you were telling me these things, I would be telling you the same thing. Yeah, it's very impressive. But as I observe myself, I'm not impressed, because I'm not done. You know, I'm not done. I just want to keep getting better. I just want to keep learning. I want to do the best that I can possibly do. And, you know, the reflection of that is the reactions and the sense of camaraderie amongst my peers that I enjoy, and also seeing gratified audiences and realizing that, you know, this music, it's a spiritual salve, and we need it. If we didn't need it, it wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if there was no usefulness for this thing, then people wouldn't still want it. There's something there. I mean, if Oliver Sacks wrote a book called Musicophilia, and he talks about how music, there's no center in the brain that's specifically for music. What happens is music touches all of the parts of the brain. Maybe you hear that song and it, you remember the first time that you heard it. So that's one way you relate to it. You're hearing the words of the song and you're perceiving the story. That's one way. You're hearing the sounds, you're feeling the rhythms. That's another way. So it's touching all of these parts of our brain. And so it's so rich and the way that it stimulates the mind. And I, you know, there's another book that I like a lot too, called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. And that book is really, it leads me to these types of conclusions that when we prepare ourselves to experience more and more detail, we enjoy what we're doing more and more. And it acts as a space filler, so that all your worries and your anxieties and your, you know, to-do list and your fight with your significant other and all of that stuff, it gets pushed out of your mind, and all of that space is filled with music. And I look at it as like it's like it recharges us. So then when we're done with the music, then we get to go back and we can deal with those things with a renewed energy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I had another question. I was going to piggyback and finish things up, but you did such a great job at describing music and
how we
need jazz. That's beautiful. Yeah, I think we've hit a very succinct and very beautiful endpoint of the interview.
Sounds good, man.
David, it was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate the interest.
Thank you. Stay cool.
All right, take care.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to David Gibson for his cool and the music he puts out there. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.